back to the American Revolution podcast, episode 48, Fort Washington. So here we are, the last major event that's going to happen in the New York campaign, and that's the fall of Fort Washington. At the end of Manhattan Island, where it narrows and the Harlem River flows into the Hudson River, we have a piece of high ground known as Mount Washington. Today, it's better known to New Yorkers as Washington Heights. The hill was about a mile long and stood 230 feet above the Hudson River. On the top of the hill, Colonel Rufus Putnam, the Army's chief engineer, a man that we've had run-ins with before, laid out plans for the fort. Colonels Robert McGaw and John Shee, with their regiments, the 3rd and 5th Pennsylvania, respectively, were in charge of building the fort. The fort was started on July 21st, 1776, so prior to the battle at Brooklyn, the fort starts to be built. The fort was a pentagonal earthwork with 5 bastions. The whole fort covered about 4 acres. Now, this is a pretty large-sized fort, but it was simple. It had earthen walls with no outer works like trenches or abatis. Now, abatis are what you get when you build a redoubt. It's a trench in front of the earthen redoubt. And what a lot of people or a lot of armies would do is they would put broken branches. Any of the stuff that you couldn't really use to build the fortifications, that leftover scrap, you would throw that in there. And it just became a hazard for anyone trying to overtake the redoubt. They would have to climb through broken twigs and branches and all kinds of nonsense. And it was just meant to slow soldiers down so that you could take shots at them. If an army is charging the wall and they have a clear path to the wall, they would have a better chance of overtaking it. But when you throw all this debris in your way, it actually slows them up. So abatis was a trench filled with branches and such that kind of slowed up approaching armies. To make matters worse, they didn't have any casemates, bomb-proofs, barracks, or just buildings in general. Except for a wooden magazine, which that wouldn't do anything. Most magazines were built into the ground. Yet there was a wooden door and a covering that would come in to that you would walk into. I apologize for any slowing up in this. I'm actually trying to record this podcast while the storm apocalypse is going on outside. So you're getting all this live, because if you heard something in the background, that was my entire house shaking from a really bad piece of thunder. Anyway, moving on. So bomb-proofs were dug into the ground. You had a wooden door that entered into the bomb-proof, but it was always underground because you would assume that a mortar round that would come down on top of the bomb-proof would, it would just blow up earth and it wouldn't affect any of the gunpowder below. But they had a wooden magazine. So if an incendiary round or a mortar round goes into that magazine, well, forget about it. The entire magazine is done. Besides this wooden magazine, you also have a couple of offices. But those are the only buildings inside the fort. The fort also lacked, water. The most simplest of things. It lacked a well for water. So the only way the soldiers inside the fort were able to get water is it would have to be brought up from the Hudson twice a day. Well, this is going to prove difficult under a siege because, who's going to go out and go down to the river and get the water when the enemy is right outside the gates? So kind of poor planning on the setup of the fort. So it begins to – at least some historians will really ask, what good was the fort? I mean, it just seems like it's more trouble than it's worth. Funny enough, those are the exact same thoughts that Washington was having. Now, Nathaniel Greene felt that the fort – Fort Washington and Fort Lee worked really well in tandem. He thought that they would protect the Hudson River and that they were key to protecting – these sunken chevaux de frise and sunken ships that were purposefully sunk to kind of block British warships from moving upriver. So Fort Washington, Fort Lee need to be left standing because they're just too important for protection of the Hudson. He also felt that, well, Fort Washington left a good foothold on Manhattan so that it was possible for the Americans to come back and overtake Manhattan once again when they got their numbers back up, or they were able to defeat the British out in the field, and then they would have a better chance of defeating the defending army in the city. So where we left off, now the entire fort is built in the summer months, and it's left standing during Harlem Heights, Throgs Neck, Pell's Point, White Plains. Now we're here, it's November. And where we left off was Washington had pulled out of White Plains and has now moved his army on the other side of the border into New Jersey. Presumably, he's looking to start winter quarters. Howe split his army. One group headed south to deal with the forts, while the rest were waiting to see the next move that the Americans were going to make. And Howe stayed up in the north towards the area of North Castle, where Washington had last moved his troops after the Battle of White Plains. So that's where we are with the armies in the field. Now, Washington, once again, it is now November. You know, he had the forts during the battles around Manhattan, Brooklyn, Harlem, so on. But now he's pulling out of New York altogether. He has been forced out of New York by the British. So what good is it going to be to leave Fort Washington garrisoned? What good will that do him? So he wants to abandon the fort. Green, once again, says this is a bad idea. He still says that it is important to protect the Hudson. It would hold against any attack, and it was their foothold back on Manhattan. It really doesn't help matters that Israel Putnam is also saying that the fort should stay. You see, Israel Putnam was a man that was loyal to McGaw. He said that since McGaw was in command of the fort would hold till December. If he needed to move the garrison, he would be able to and get it across the river without much trouble at all. The only thing that bothers me about the logic of that, on November 7th, three British warships sailed right through the defenses, right past the forts, right over the Chevaux de Frise, and up the Hudson. So, historians out there, I ask, what good are these forts? Funny enough, on November 8th, Washington asked the same question. He says, the late passage of three vessels up the North River is so plain a proof of the inefficiency of all the obstructions we have thrown into it that I cannot but think it will fully justify a change in the disposition which has been made. If we cannot prevent vessels passing and the enemy are possessed of the surrounding country, what valuable purpose can it answer to hold a post of which the expected benefit cannot be had? In layman's terms, what good are these forts? But Washington was a trusting man, and we've talked about this. He is loyal to his commanders to a fault. And though it is a great quality, it's a great quality of any commander to listen to your subordinates or to your adjutant generals or to your camp commanders, your field commanders, these are all men that can help you win battles. But in this case, I wish Washington would have put his foot down. He trusts the young general and left it to his discretion as to the fate of Fort Washington. Green plans to hold the fort. And as it seems, the surrounding area as well, which was a little weird. Because besides the two Pennsylvania regiments under McGaw and Shee that he had in the fort already, he also sent Colonel Moses Rawlins and his regiment of Maryland and Virginia riflemen, Colonel Baxter with his Bucks County, Pennsylvania militia, and some other various units, to the point where McGaw's number had swelled to about 2,900 men. This was way too much to keep the fort, and the evidence shows us that Green was planning to occupy some of the previous positions that were left vacant when Washington moved the army from Manhattan over into upper New York towards White Plains and so on. So besides the troops in the fort, McGaugh had placed his and Shee's Pennsylvania regiments in the fortified lines at Harlem Heights under the command of Lieutenant Colonel Lambert Cadwalder. He also placed Rawlins' riflemen with the militia and some artillery and Fletch's protecting the eastern approaches of these two positions. So basically, there were some Fletch's in between the old fortified lines at Harlem Heights and Fort Washington itself. And on the east side of Manhattan is where they placed Rawlins' men and this artillery. There were also some small detachments posted in other areas. And McGaugh was in command of the fort with its small garrison. I mean, this is a bold strategy, and, you know, you just left to wonder. Let's see if it pays off for him. Spoiler alert, it doesn't pay off. He's trying to hold an area 5 square miles, and it's not a very large force. Yes, almost 3,000 men is a decent-sized force, but it's not enough to cover 5 square miles. If you wanted to protect Fort Washington and you wanted to dig outer works like trenches and so on, then maybe he could do something. But Howe had planned out the attack on the American position with 3 simultaneous attacks by over 8,000 redcoats. Lord Percy would attack Cadwalder's position on Harlem Heights with a division, 1 brigade of Hessians, and 9 British battalions. That's a lot of men. He had over 4,000 men himself. General Matthews with 2 battalions of light infantry and 2 battalions of guards, supported by 2 battalions of grenadiers and the 33rd Regiment of Foot. Those supporting battalions would be under the command of Lord Charles Cornwallis, were going to cross the Harlem River and take on Baxter's militia. General Wilhelm von Knappenhausen wanted the honor of making the main attack. He would lead 3,000 German troops against Rawlins' men. Along with these 3 coordinated attacks, there would be a feint by the 42nd Highlanders under Colonel Sterling. Different Sterling. It's also spelled differently. This is not the beloved Sterling on the American side, a man who has become a personal hero to me for all his awesomeness. We are going to talk about Sterling in future episodes, but just know that Colonel Sterling is the cheap British knockoff, so don't get those two confused. He's going to move to a point between Cadwalder's position at the fortified lines on Harlem Heights and the fort to confuse the colonials. He wants to throw Cadwalder's men into disarray and think that there's going to be a main assault onto the fort and kind of like turn his back while Percy assaults the main line. I think that's kind of what the effect was supposed to be. Well, with all these plans laid out, the Americans in position, on the night of November 14th, 30 British flatboats sailed up into the Harlem River, completely unobserved by the Americans. And the next day, a Lieutenant Colonel Patterson, the Adjutant General of the British Army, will arrive before Fort Washington, asking McGaugh to surrender or be put to death when captured. McGaugh will respond in kind, saying, "I will defend this fort to the last." This is just a normal banter. No man was prepared to defend the fort to the last. No man was prepared to execute the captured. It just wasn't going to happen. Both sides are just trying to posture, or I like to say peacocking, flashing their feathers. They want to avoid a full engagement. The British would take the day of the 15th to ready all 4 digits of this fist that they're going to close on the American fort. At 7 a.m. on the morning of the 16th, a 21-gun battery from the east side of the Harlem River and the frigate Pearl with her guns will open up on all American positions. The barrage lasted for about 3 hours. At about 10 o'clock in the morning, Percy's division will advance on Cadwalder's position. Percy's field artillery opened up a small gap that the British could press into. Percy was able to march his men through the Holloway pretty much unopposed and get into position in front of the fortified lines on the American side of Harlem Heights. Cadwalder will answer with his own and lone 6-pounder. There isn't much of a fight, though. You see, after a short time, Percy will pull his men back to a wooded area where they actually wait for about an hour and a half. Well, this is very perplexing to the Americans. They attacked us, but then they stopped. You see, what happens is Matthews and his light infantry are delayed. So this is going to hold up everything for the British attack. And Percy has to pull his men back to a safe position, which he does. And he's going to hold up until he gets word that he can resume the attack. There was some trouble with the tides. The British did not do a good job of planning and coordinating their assaults to work with the tides. So what happens is Matthew's men are stuck on the other side of the Harlem River until the tides are in a better position so that they can get across. Once they get across, they come under heavy fire from Colonel William Baxter's men. Now the light infantry will try and rush up Laurel Hill. They're trying to create a distraction because Cornwallis is coming in right behind the light infantry. He has grenadiers and the 33rd Regiment of foot. Once Cornwallis is in on the other side of the Harlem, he wastes no time and follows the light infantry right up the hill. At the top of the hill, there was a short fight. Though Baxter's men were in a strong position, nothing could stop the hands of fate. Not long after the fight had started at the hill, Baxter is shot in the head and killed, and of course, without their commander, the militia retreats to the fort. So Cornwallis has met with victory on his position. Knappenhausen started his march to the fort at 7 a.m., crossing Kingsbridge. He actually split his army into two columns, Knappenhausen with Major General Martin Schmidt of the British Army will have the left column. Colonel Johann Rahl will have the right column. When they crossed the bridge, they were poised to make their assault on Rawlins' position, but due to the delay of Cornwallis' force, they have to hold position. But at 10 a.m., they get word that they can resume the assault. Knappenhausen led his men forward. They were met with American artillery and Rawlins' rifles. Rahl moved his column along the Hudson River toward Mount Washington. So this is where battlefield maps would be super helpful, and I really wish I could show you guys so you could better understand. It's one of those things, sometimes I wish I did a video podcast, but unfortunately I just don't have the means, money, and unfortunately studio space. I do this off my laptop, basically on my living room couch. But to try and best explain it, when you come down from Kingsbridge, which are coming down from the north, Knappenhausen's column would be the left. So if you were walking down from going south, the left column goes straight for the fort. The Hudson River is on your right side, so Rahl takes his detachment and actually skirts the river to try and make a flanking maneuver to head up towards the fort. And this is where they kind of run into Moses Rollins' men. See, Rollins' men held Fletches, and if you're looking at a battlefield map, the Fletches are more towards the northeast, so they protect the fort, where the fort is kind of on the west side of everything, because it's on the Hudson River. So Rahl actually tries to do this move to flank those Fletches, while Knappenhausen goes right for the Fletches head on. So I hope that explanation kind of makes sense. I'm really sorry. You know, sometimes when I do the episodes like this, I wish I could show you guys a map, or better, even better if, you know, you had a book or something in front of you. Unfortunately, I don't have a lot of good maps, resources in my library of American Revolution books, so I don't have one to suggest for that. I'm sorry. But anyway, I digress. So back to the Germans. At 10 a.m., they get word to resume the assault. Knappenhausen led his men forward. They were met with American artillery and Rollins rifles. Rahl will move his column along the Hudson River towards Mount Washington. And Rahl and Knappenhausen are going to press their men up to the top of the hill. But the Americans are in a strong position. And the Germans are going to make several pushes up the hill, only to be forced back. And Rollins' men did a beautiful job of holding their position. The problem is their equipment. Their rifles, though, were very effective at distance. The problem is the constant firing was clogging the rifle itself, making it so that they could not seat another shot. And so eventually the heavy fire from the Patriots was actually dwindling down, and the Germans were able to press, you know, even harder up the hill because they were just running out of guns to shoot. Their guns were clogging. So Rollins knew that his men would either have to retreat or risk being captured. So he pulls them back to the fort. That's the second assault. While all this is going on, Percy had led his men, once again, against Cadwalader's position. Percy and Cornwallis will actually link up. But the Americans are holding pretty tough. The Pennsylvanians are a tough group. And this is where the 42nd will actually come into play. The feint attack was still on. The 42nd Highlanders were still in the field. And they actually ordered, they are actually ordered to move against Cadwalader's position. And Cadwalader is just overwhelmed. There's just too much going on. He can't hold out against such an overwhelming force. So he, too, is forced to retreat and head back to the fort. In the fort, there is over 2,500 men now. Rall will approach the fort under a flag of truce. Rall simply says, "Magoa, you need to surrender the fort." Magoa had no choice. He's outnumbered, the fort is overcrowded, and if the British began to shell the fort, it would become a slaughterhouse. They had no protection. There was no way that these troops were going to be able to hold the fort against an artillery attack. By the numbers, at least in casualty numbers, the Americans don't suffer a huge loss. They have 59 killed and 96 are wounded. It's in their captured numbers that it's pretty bad. 230 officers are captured along with 2,600 infantry. Now the British will lose 78 killed and 374 wounded. So the Americans gave a pretty good fight for a little while. A couple of days after the fall of Fort Washington, Fort Lee will also fall, but that really wasn't much of a fight, and we'll talk about that next episode when we talk about Washington's retreat into Jersey. We actually talk about Fort Lee, and we kind of review his feelings on the loss of Fort Washington. This is going to rank as one of the worst disasters of the war for the Americans, not just the fact that they lost they have almost 3,000 men captured, but the fact that they lost 146 pieces of artillery, 12,000 shot and shell, 2,800 muskets, and over 400,000 cartridges. It's just all around a bad situation for the Americans. And you got to place the blame squarely on Nathanael Greene. Why do you want to hold the fort? What was the purpose of holding the fort? There was nothing to be gained. I think that Magoa could have pulled his men out, realizing the situation he was in, try and make some sort of at least escape attempt. I mean, the worst that could happen is you're going to get captured anyway. You're going to get captured in the fort. You're going to get captured out there. But maybe some of your men could get away. Unfortunately, it's a waste of some damn fine infantry. And that's something I actually am going to talk about in future episodes. I'm actually planning on doing a bonus episode. I remember saying, actually last night, in our bonus episode about Nathan Hale, I would like to do the Germans. But I feel that all this talk of what happens with captured soldiers and everything, I'm actually going to sideline the Germans for now. There will be plenty of instances where we can talk about Hessians in the field of battle. But when we talk about captured soldiers, I actually want to talk about the prison ships in New York Harbor. And I feel that since we're kind of sticking around the New York area for now, I think this might be an interesting bonus episode. So I'm going to throw that out there for you guys. The next bonus episode will be after we do some talking about the defenses of the Hudson River. And it's going to be about life on the prison ship Jersey. I actually have I've picked up a book, a firsthand account of a soldier on the prison ship. So I think that that might be an interesting bonus episode. And I'm going to throw that out there. Once again, though, the bonus episodes do not come without a price. I know that I've asked many a time, and I just want to try and get more listeners out there. So I'm hoping that if I can get five more 5-star reviews, or a couple of new 5-star reviews, and a bunch of people possibly forwarding the Facebook page to new members or friends of theirs that might have an interest in the American Revolution. If I could get some support in any way to try and just get more people listening, I will do the episode on the prison ship, New Jersey. It's an episode I really want to do, and I hope you guys really want to hear about it because it is a very interesting topic. And I really feel bad for those that have already done, you know, really well by me by giving me 5-star reviews or putting out these really nice messages out on the Facebook, you know, kind of just giving me a lot of support. And I don't think that it goes unappreciated because it really does. And I can't say that enough. But I want to try and get as many listeners as possible. And I'm going to be doing this for as long as it takes me to get through the war. And I have no problem doing this if I had 2 listeners. But I really hope I can get more people to start listening to the podcast. So if I can get a couple more 5-star reviews or some referrals on the Facebook page, I will gladly do another bonus episode like I did this week with Nathan Hale on the prison ship, New Jersey. So let's keep that in mind. I will be back next week. We are going to talk about the retreat through Jersey, and we are going to put Washington to bed for just a little while. The next plan, and I've gotten, the people who go onto the Facebook and answer poll questions or throw questions to me about stuff that we've talked about, it's just been awesome. I'm loving that I put a poll up, and a lot of people seem to be wanting to learn about, well, what were these river defenses on the Hudson? And so that's going to be our next point. So we're going to be talking about some river defenses after we talk after we close out the New York campaign. And then we're going to rewind time. We are going to rewind time, and we are going to head back to the beginning of 1776, and we're going to talk about what's going on in the North. So that's kind of the next plan, the plan for the next probably few months as we move on and we work our way through 1776. So till next week, once again, I appreciate all the support of my loyal listeners, and I want to say, as always, keep that powder dry.